Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. Hope you've come through this interlull uninjured, unscathed, and ready to go. There are no more interlulls now. That's it. They're done. They're dusted. They're over. Fuck off. See you later. See you next season. We don't have to worry about that anymore. We just have to worry about the small matter of what is the run-in. And this is no ordinary run-in. This isn't a run-in to see if we can finish sixth. This isn't a run-in where we're going, do we really want to finish seventh and qualify for the Europa Crapification League, whatever it's called? I can't remember. Doesn't matter anyway, because this season, this time around, our run-in is to the finish line, the proper crock of gold at the end of the rainbow finish line. That is what we are going for. That's what we've got to play for. That's what the next 2 months are going to be about. 10 games, 2 months, a lot of excitement because, you know, let's face it, this is where we've wanted to be. This is when we have been through the bad times, the doldrums, and we've talked and said, we just want a team that can compete. We just want to be able to compete at the top of the table until the end of the season. And here we are, and it is exciting, and it's also a bit terrifying. There's no two ways about it, but isn't it so much better than just floundering around in mid-table or scrapping away for a top four? This is really, without trying to sound too cliched, what it's all about. And fingers crossed that we can do the business in these next 10 games. Of course, we will be taking them one game at a time. And thankfully, that is the way the schedule is set up, so it's pretty handy in that regard. It is a double header for you today. We're going to talk tickets now in just a moment. After that, I'll be chatting to Clive Palmer of Arsenal Vision podcast fame. We'll be shooting the breeze about what's to come between now and the end of May and much more. But first, to talk about the thorny issue of ticketing, because demand has been so high this season because the team is good. But there are issues, I think, that people are experiencing with various levels of membership, people buying from unofficial websites, and even the ongoing issue of touting. To talk more about that and what the club are doing, I'm joined by Tim Payton from the Arsenal Supporters Trust. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. You're enjoying the season so far, I take it?
I'm loving it. Look at the grey hairs. I can see maybe a few coming your way too. We're loving it, but it's aging us, isn't it?
It is a bit, but it's better than the alternative. That is for sure. Now, look, we're going to talk tickets because this is a contentious issue. The tickets for Wolves went on sale this week. Some lucky people got tickets. A lot of unlucky people didn't get tickets. And there are a lot of questions about how tickets are distributed, about where tickets are going, some of the unofficial markets and everything else. But before we get on to that, you guys in the AST, you did a call with Tom McCann and Amy Trinka from Arsenal to talk about the situation with tickets, the demand that is through the roof this season for very obvious reasons. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of it, just like how much of this problem, in inverted commas, is simply a consequence of the team being good and therefore demand for these tickets is just through the roof compared to what it was over the past couple of seasons?
That's exactly it. That's the fundamental reason everybody wants to watch Arsenal. Mm. That has the ticketing system hasn't really been tested or put under duress for maybe more than a decade now. I think it was Arsenal's chief executive, Vinay Venetkin, who acknowledged to me at a recent advisory board meeting that the system had been built over several years, perhaps, you know, patched together is too strong a word, I'm paraphrasing, but my word is it getting a test this season, because nobody quite saw, I think, demand going to where it is now. Alongside that, Arsenal are doing some very good things. They're modernising. They've got a new team in charge, and they've done things that AST has been calling for a long time, like the use it or lose it, trying to open up more seats, get more transfer and ticket exchange. But it's kind of like everything that they had has been blown away by this phenomenal demand. Everybody wants to get in and watch Arsenal.
So red members and silver members, you know, you don't have to look too hard on Twitter to find people complaining about the fact that there just aren't tickets there. And like I said, we can all understand that. I mean, to what extent are the club trying to facilitate more access to tickets for silver members and for red members? I mean, red members could be, you know, that group is growing all the time because it's open to everybody. I think the silver membership numbers are the same anyway. They're more or less static, aren't they? But the red members can just get bigger and bigger and bigger because, you know, as the club and as the team gets more fans, people want to join, people want to become a red member. And even if it's a slim chance of getting a ticket, that is the official way of getting a ticket. So how are they trying their best behind the scenes to make sure that tickets are distributed as evenly and as fairly as they can be?
Okay, that's a really big question, but let me try and hone in.
Yeah.
First of all, I think the most important thing is to have every seat used, because if a seat is empty, that really is a tragedy for everybody who's trying to get in. Now, some people know, and some people accuse me of banging on too much about this, but one of my things for more than a decade has been the number of empty seats in the Emirates. Now, perhaps it hasn't mattered quite so much when the demand wasn't really high. But the current team, and I give full credit to them, they introduced at the beginning of this season the use it or lose it policy. And it was you had to go to at least 10 Premier League games or you would lose your season ticket. And what that has seen is more people putting them into ticket exchange, more people transferring them, and we've seen a much higher utilisation. That's one way of getting more tickets in the system. Extraordinarily, Andrew, it sort of does my head in. Last year, under the use it or lose it policy, there would have been more than 1,000 tickets rescinded. People paying all this money and not coming, including more than a couple of hundred where the season ticket wasn't used at all. I mean, it beggars belief to me, but there are people out there. But the good thing is I think the club are determined to implement it at the end of this season, and they are getting used a lot more. The policy's working, but there still could be a couple of hundred tickets coming back into the system from people who still aren't coming to enough Arsenal games. And it's not that you have to come, it's that you have to put it on the ticket exchange so that someone else can come.
Yeah.
So that's the most important thing. And the Arsenal Supporters Trust for next year, we are pushing the club to up that amount, push that further next year and go up to a requirement that at least 75% of games are used by a season ticket holder, kind of 17, 18 out of the 22 that are on the season ticket next year. And that, of course, helps everybody because there are more tickets that will be available. Talking of the ticket exchange, we've also asked that silver members and red members who bought tickets have access to it, because you might buy your ticket 2 months in advance and the television schedules change, or you know how fixtures move around because of cup games. So let's get as much usage of that system as possible so people can transfer and exchange. Then something else they can do is get more tickets going to supporters rather than in the hands of the ticket touts. And something they've done is they've employed an industry expert, someone that I know from my work in the sports industry is really, really good and really strong. And they are going to start doing everything from covert operations on match days to weeding through the membership lists to taking legal action against the online sites. And it will take a little bit of time, but I know that Arsenal are putting aside quite a big budget and are committed to trying to do more there. Of course, every Arsenal fan can help. If you see touted tickets, if you think the seats next to you are touted, even if you feel forced to buy off a tout yourself, at the end of the match, write to Arsenal, tell them the seat numbers, because they'll be able to look up the season ticket holder or the red member who went to the market, broke the terms and conditions and removed them. And I know at the moment they are removing a lot of people. Then something else that they really need to do, and I think you probably see this every, you probably see it at about 10 a.m., just after the ticket sale windows open, they've got to improve the experience of buying and the online queue, because people are spending hours in this queue, not sure how it's worked, getting kicked out. And I think they need to look at a better application process, perhaps a sign-in system, perhaps a ballot system, something where people aren't spending hours and hours without knowing what's happening. Something which also I think is fair to everybody. A 10 o'clock sale that is finished at 10:05 isn't fair to those who might be working in the NHS or teachers, or there are lots of jobs where you just can't get yourself in front of the IT at that time. And it should be fair to all silver and all red members. And the club say that all of these things are on the list. So there's so much they can do.
Sure. I mean, the demand, from what Amy was saying in the video, that, and I'll post the link to the video, people can have a look at that, you know, is 200% up on where it was last season. Not just 100%, 200% up. I think she said when it comes to reds and silvers, there are sort of in the region of 300 people looking per ticket, 300 people online looking per ticket. I mean, that's
on the ticket exchange.
That's ticket exchange.
As an average, on the ticket exchange, there are 300 people pressing refresh for when that one ticket comes up.
Pops up.
No wonder people find it a dissatisfying experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. So conversations over tickets and ticketing are not new, but this scenario that we have right now where the demand is so high, down to the quality of the team, to the quality of the football, the overall experience of being in a stadium when everything is as good as it is this demand anything the club could have foreseen and maybe taken steps to deal with preemptively?
Did you predict we were going to be 8 points clear of Manchester City at the beginning of April?
I don't think I did, no.
No, I actually think, and I know you've looked at the video we did with Arsenal, and in a way it speaks for itself. For the first time that I've ever been involved, for two senior executives to come on and address all the questions and all the issues and challenges and be very open and transparent, I think this is a team that are really trying to improve things. They've done quite a few gradual improvements this year, but the demand is huge. If there was an area that went wrong, and I think there was some hindsight here, and it had at its roots a nice thing to do, was they allowed more season ticket holders into the system at the beginning of this year. Because what they did, if you recall, they gave a COVID holiday to people.
Sure.
People who were nervous about coming back were allowed to take a year out. And then they sold the sort of spare as further season tickets. This year, they allowed everybody to come back, and more people came back than they expected. I think perhaps seeing the beginning of the kind of Mikel Arteta uplift and excitement. And then they let the 500 or so who'd bought for 1 year also stay as season ticket holders. Now, I think with hindsight, that was a poor decision, perhaps driven a little bit by commerciality, because season tickets sold, if Arsenal aren't very good, is money in the bank at the beginning of the year. And they've been, you know, in effect, everybody's been caught unawares a bit by the extreme demand.
Sure.
Having made that decision, I think the thing, and this is what certainly AST is saying to them, they absolutely must at the very least do everything they can to get the silver allocation back to the size it was last year, because the silvers are fighting for a smaller allocation this year, 30,000 of them going after 2,500 tickets, and it's just not working. Although to be fair to the club, that 30,000 and roughly 2,500 to 3,000 available has worked well for 10 years without any issues. And it is just think how fast things have turned. This time last year, or certainly last season, Arsenal didn't sell out Chelsea or Manchester City until the day of the game. The speed of the transformation from an Arsenal ticket being available basically to anybody who wanted it to them being like gold dust has caught everybody unawares. So how I judge Arsenal at the moment is how they're trying to address this. And I do think they are doing everything possible, but something I say, and it doesn't always make me possible with everybody, is you cannot get 120,000 people into the Emirates Stadium every week. So
no.
There are going to be upset people and tough decisions, because everybody who gets a ticket, there's several other people who haven't got that one.
Yeah.
And the thing that I steer clear of, because how can the AST, how can anybody really make a decision on what's loyalty? You know,
yeah.
It's so hard, isn't it? Is the person that flies from Australia or America for one game, how do you prioritise them or put them into a system versus someone from North London who might come an average of two or three times a year for the last 30 years versus a Red member who did come to pretty much every game when, in their words, we were rubbish and I was still there? I'm glad I don't have that tough decision to make at the end of the day of who gets one.
For sure. And look, you know, that is a consequence of, you know, football and Arsenal being a global club, right now, global sport, global club, and the fact that we have fans who come from all over the world for every single game. Every time I'm over, I meet people from pretty much everywhere. You know, is an amazing thing. It really is an incredible thing. So it is a difficult one, as you say. I mean, one of the things you mentioned was touts. And I suppose one of the conversations I've seen quite a lot this week on Twitter is, well, I'm a silver member, I'm a red member, I queued for ages, I can't get a ticket for love nor money. I do a quick Google, I come across these sites, and they say, well, they've got 254 tickets. Where are they getting these tickets? I just had a quick look now at the top three when you do the Google for Arsenal Wolves tickets, and their sites, I'm sure that people will know. Minimum £1,000 for an Arsenal Wolves ticket on these sites. Can you explain how they work? Is it a case that they have, I saw one in particular, it's like one site, we have 254 tickets for Arsenal versus Wolves. Do they have 254 tickets for Arsenal versus Wolves? And if not, what are they selling people?
They do not have 254 tickets. They might have some. What they are doing is in effect speculating. So they're going out there and seeing who will give them £1,000. Then they will go to their contacts and go out into the sort of unofficial marketplace where tickets swirl around and try and get hold of one. Mm. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But I would give a warning to a lot of Arsenal fans, do not use these sites, because increasingly we hear from people who paid £1,000. And if you read the small print, it doesn't guarantee you a ticket. They will give you the money back in the final 24 hours if they haven't been able to source one. And we came across someone the other day who'd flown over from America and was told in the final few hours that the ticket they paid for wasn't available because they don't have all of these tickets that they're selling. Mm. They put them on there at these crazy high prices, thinking that they can then go and, in the clearing market, in effect, find them. But there are also a lot of tickets being touted, and this is why Arsenal are spending a lot of money to deal with it. One thing people might see happening at the moment, it's being trialled, but an increasing number of people are using digital ticketing only to enter the stadium. And this is where, I'm not very good at IT, but this is where you get a barcode that revolves. So the barcode is constantly moving on your digital ticketing. Mm. So you can't print it out on paper.
Like a one-time code for logging into your internet banking, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And it's only live or real. At the moment, you go through the turnstile and it confirms to you. What it stops you doing is creating a PDF or screenshot and sending it to somebody else, and then they turn up with like a fixed picture because that was out of date by the time you arrived. And I suspect, and Arsenal are looking at, that this might be something that everybody is using next season. And it's a really important thing to crack down on the touting. Just as I know Arsenal are looking at, because we pressured them to do this, particularly the Red membership, when you sign up, maybe do an ID verification, maybe even put a photo on the Red membership. These are possibly very small inconveniences to your average fan, but I think we should all go with them to help stop the touting and help keep the crowd in the stadium being true Arsenal fans who are paying a fair price. And lots of different measures are going to have to be introduced by Arsenal. I think there'll be more people outside stadiums. I think there'll be messages in the tube stations, people with megaphones warning, working with the police, because it is a criminal offence to resell a ticket. Mm. So we have to persuade the police to actually start to move in and do some arrests outside the stadium. And then there are all sorts of technological solutions which can be applied to the membership lists. So if you do have 36 Arsenal fans living in your household, which is unlikely, but I think you'll find that there were quite a lot registered like that. Funnily enough, who are they? That's the sort of thing that the more sophisticated software is going to be getting on top of.
So, I mean, for these tickets to hit this sort of secondary market or whatever, I mean, is it a case that it is Arsenal fans looking at, well, look at that, ticket I spent 90 quid on is now worth a grand or whatever. Maybe you don't get a grand, maybe you get whatever, and they obviously do a markup on those. I mean, is it really Arsenal fans, or are these basically well-organized touts taking advantage of the membership scheme to get these tickets in the first place?
Most of it is well-organized touts who are infiltrating the system. Mm. And they've been around for years because, yeah, they've always been big games. There's always been Spurs and Manchester United or the game to decide to come forth. So there are touts everywhere. There will be touts within the gold season ticket membership. There will be touts in the silver membership, but particularly in red, because you could sign up for 50 new red memberships tomorrow. And you pay your small, I call it notional. Maybe I shouldn't call it notional because people have to pay that. But in the context of a £1,000 ticket, it's a notional cost to buy your red membership. And then you're out there operating. So the whole system needs cleaning up and looking at. But at one level, it's really sophisticated and there is quite big money here. And of course, the organised touts, they're not just targeting Arsenal, they're targeting Chelsea and Manchester United, and they kind of get economy of scale from linking up to the online sites. All the online sites, by the way, which the servers are hosted overseas, which is how they try and stay outside of the UK's laws, which make it a criminal offence to resell.
Yeah. Well, look, it is an ongoing issue. I suppose the one positive is that it's primarily because the team is good and the team is potentially going to do something fantastic. So how much are you looking forward to the last 10 games of this season?
Oh, it's so exciting. I can't wait. I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm not going to say the terrible words on your podcast so that people can't come back and get me for the next 10 years. I've got everything crossed and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, look, I think your power and influence doesn't go quite that far, Tim. So we will keep everything crossed. As ever, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed to Tim. You can find a link in the show notes to the AST video that I mentioned in this conversation, Tim and Akhil from the AST talking to Tom and Amy from Arsenal about the ticketing situation. Loads of info in there about what the club are doing and trying to do and how they're trying to cope with this, I guess, unprecedented demand and the difficulties that fans are having in getting tickets to see the game. So there's more in that video. Like I said, you will find that in the show notes, and you can find out more about the Arsenal Supporters Trust at arsenaltrust.org.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Okay, with me now on the Arsecast to look ahead to the resumption of the Premier League, the 10 games we have left to go, and lots more besides, I'm joined by Clive Palmer. Hi, Clive.
Hello, hello. How are you?
I am all right. I'm all right this morning. I am going back in time with you, which I know is your favorite thing because you have this photographic memory of...
Oh, yes. Of bumbling around North London, sitting outside Kentucky Fried Chicken shops. Yeah, I've got a great memory.
Well, at least you know it was Kentucky Fried Chicken and not Wendy's or something. No.
Well, we're going to help, mate, as always.
All right. Well, look, we're going back because this week Arsene Wenger was inducted into the Premier League Hall of Fame, along with Alex Ferguson, who, of course, was the big rival back in the day when Manchester United and Arsenal were the two best teams in England, scrapping it out for the Premier League. You know, we're on the precipice of we're in the middle of a Premier League title challenge.
Yeah.
For the first time in quite a while, a real one, a serious one for the first one in quite a while. But when you go back to those days, it was the expectation. It was, in many ways, the norm. What do you remember about those seasons, particularly when you got to this stage of the season, when you have like a game against Manchester United coming up, a game against maybe some of the bigger teams? How do you remember dealing with that beyond drinking lots of Stella and eating Kentucky Fried Chicken? How about that?
I remember I felt very much at the time that we were the team that no one wanted to win. Mm. It felt like Manchester United were like England's team. And they had the British manager that knew all the other managers and sat in with them, had a glass of wine afterwards and knew all the referees. And you could almost feel his influence over the FA and over the whole game.
Mm.
And some of those managers were our opponents. They used to play a bit better against us than they did against Manchester United. So I had this massive inferiority complex around why do they want us not to win type thing, you know? Mm. And whether that was true or not, in my mind, it was perfectly reasonable, you know? And I just felt that the game was much more enamoured with Ferguson than it was Wenger. And they accepted Wenger only when he was too hard to ignore. That makes sense, Ed?
Yeah. I know what you mean, because, yeah, like you say, they had the golden generation of England players with Beckham and Scholes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Ferguson was well established in the Premier League at that point, and this young-ish upstart from France via Japan. What does a guy from France know about English football? I think Ferguson said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but there was a skepticism and an almost a dismissal of him, because I think he was maybe only the second or third foreign manager in the Premier League at that time. There was the dude at Aston Villa.
Bengalus, was he?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And maybe the one more.
Brain's working,
yeah,
man.
It's not bad at all. You bailed me out there. But the creation of a team that challenged all the time. I know there were a couple of seasons where United won it relatively comfortably, but there were other seasons where it was quite close and we had some difficult ends of season because of late results, and they were difficult because the season had got to that point where the last two or three games it was tied, it was close, and one defeat, one bad result either way for either team could swing the title in the direction that they didn't want it to go. I mean, can you remember? I mean, I can remember some of the Manchester United games and sitting watching on television and literally shaking. I mean, I know that's because I was a younger man and everything else, but you know, the excitement, the rivalry, it's now when you see Ferguson and Wenger talk about each other, there's a measure of respect. You know, they've juked it out and they've come through it and they're older men and they're wiser and they've calmed down and all that kind of stuff. But the ferocity of that rivalry between those two managers, those sets of players, the fans, everything was... I don't think we'll ever see the like of it again, because we're in an era where there are more clubs capable of competing. We're not going to have just two behemoths. Maybe the Man City-Liverpool rivalry a little bit over the last couple of years is like that, but I don't think it's come anywhere close to what United and Arsenal was back in the day.
Yeah, I think the Premier League would love to have something like this again. they'd love to, but everyone loves each other now, didn't they? Hugging in the tunnels and changing shirts at half time and tapping each other on the back on Instagram. That wasn't the case in 98 when we played in the Overmars game. That was not the case at all in 2002 when we went to Old Trafford and Patrick Vieira had his best game. That these were full-on wars. They were full-on wars. And the fans were bought into that completely. I can remember the 98 game. And I was going for a weekend away in Newcastle, actually, and we stopped off to watch the game. And it was almost like the moment when everything changed when Overmars scored. And it was like, this is it. We are here. And you lot, it's happening now. And we rolled on and won that league. And then we were there right the way through till, you know, 2005, 2006, that whole period. But that period from 98 to 2004, for me, was the best teams, the best Wenger, but also the way by which we approached it, Andrew, in an English football environment where physicality, earning the right to play, was really important. You know, we talk today about patterns and building up in a 3-2-5 and having the five lanes of attack captured and rotating triangles in wide areas because we've all grown up. And but actually, at that time, it was Ray Parlour, Patrick Vieira, we're having it with you. What you got?
Yeah.
You know, and it's our best versus your best. And it literally was like that. It was a completely different game. And you had to earn the right to compete and earn the right to play and earn the right to win. And those were the measures of success in those times.
But, I mean, I feel like that is still the case because there's a quote in the little video that Wenger does on the Premier League website. He says, "When I look back today and how that whole season went, I really feel like I was crazy." He said, "Your craziness can kill you, but as well, your craziness can make you achieve remarkable things." And I know exactly what you're saying about that physicality, and you have to be able to stand up for yourself. And I think more back then, because, you know, that perception that Arsenal were, in inverted commas, the foreign club, weren't we the first club to play in the Premier League without an Englishman in the starting lineup, all those kinds of things, the Frenchness, you know, that they tried to, I guess, kick out of us at times. You did need to be competitive. You did need to be physical, all of those things. And I think now when we, like you said, when we talk about the game, there is perhaps an increased sophistication to the game now because of just how high the level is, the managers we've got, the head coaches we've got, the tactical aspects of the game, like you say, building up patterns of play, the five, all those, you know, juego de posición Pep has brought in and all of that kind of stuff, right? I think that's true. But at the same time, you can't achieve anything without competing physically. Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to go around kicking the shit out of everybody, but it does mean that when you're playing, you have to be able to compete in terms of your sprints, your races, your challenges, your duels, of course, as Mikel Arteta likes to say. That is still a fundamental, a core part of the game, but on top of that is another layer of stuff that I guess comes with just time and things getting more advanced.
Yeah, every single coach and every single team in their team talk is, right, we're going to get on the front foot, we're going to play our football, we're going to impose ourselves on them. And the way they do it is sometimes by territory, by ball movement, speed of ball movement, by rotations, and by having good quality technical players in the areas, in the small space areas that you need to manipulate and maintain possession, and having defenders that are happy on the ball, because again, the game's changed, hasn't it, Andrew? Back in the day, the goalkeeper booted it to the halfway line and we competed for the first ball and started from there. Now we can have players in from goal kicks in the penalty box. So guess what? Our profiles of our defenders have completely changed. They have to be good on the ball. I'm not sure Big Sol would be so good for us right now, right? Building up in our penalty box. We'd all be sitting behind the settee. But at that time, he was the premier defender from the halfway line.
Yeah.
No one could run him. No one could beat him in the air. In one-on-ones, forget it. You might as well not bother. You know, so the game has changed completely, but it's still the same. You're absolutely right. The core principles of imposing yourself on your position is exactly the same as in any team sport, just that the way it's done has gone up a little bit more sophisticated, and the way the games are refereed and just the whole framework of the game, I want to say has changed, but there's just a change in emphasis. That makes sense, because someone like, if Tim Sher was listening to this right now and Dean Saunders, they would say it hasn't changed. It's exactly the same. You've all just swallowed a laptop. You know what I mean? So the game, it has changed. Just the way you approach it, the emphasis has changed. And that's just a natural evolution of sport.
Mm.
You know, we should want that to change. We shouldn't, for me, I don't want to be trapped in yesteryear. I want to be thinking about how we can get better for tomorrow. You know, so even though I remember yesteryear, I'm much more interested in where we're going rather than where we've been, if that makes sense.
I do. It does, rather. Just finally, before we move off, this particular topic, Arsene Wenger, how significant do you think it's been that he has returned this season? Because there's been a lot of water under the bridge, and the water hasn't been... there's been some choppy waters, I think you would say. And we saw him back, and we saw him back to witness an Arsenal win with, you know, one of his former captains now managing the team, with another former captain in charge of the academy, with one of his signings who played for the Invincibles as the club's now sporting director. He was technical director. He's taken a new role now as sporting director. Edu, I mean, as difficult as it was at times, Wenger's legacy is right there before our eyes, and it's a big part of what's happening this season. You know, what a sliding doors moment that was, that transfer window in 2011 when we brought Arteta in, we brought Mertesacker in, and I'm sure people have heard the story, but I'm not quite sure if people know how close the Arteta thing was to not happening. Because it was really close to not happening right at the death, and there were some compromises made by Mikel Arteta to ensure that the deal went through, because he really wanted to.
He took a pay cut.
He took a pay cut to join, you know, from Everton, which, you know, when you think about it, he could easily have just said, well, you know, I'll stay. I mean, that connection that developed between him and the football club, I mean, look where we are now.
Yeah,
could be a completely different story. I'm not saying it would be a worse story. It could have been a better story. Who knows? But when you think about the way football opens doors and allows things to happen that you don't expect, you know, it could have been very different.
Have you found yourself asking the question why Arteta feels so connected to Arsenal? Because it has been almost since day one.
Mm.
Now, we all know, we all got our reasons for the Arsenal door opening for us. You know, for me, it was Paul Davis and Charlie George and those sort of players, Liam Brady, and it just rolls on. It's normally a person or a few people or how you feel connected and you belong to a certain club. And I look at Arteta and I think, wow, you took a pay cut to arrive. Do you remember the game before he became manager, Andrew? I think we lost to City 3-0 or 3-1.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was sitting on the bench and we were in disarray. Red seats everywhere. I'm thinking, mate, do you want this job? Seriously, do you want to put your career into this job? And as soon as he arrived, it's like, it's as though that was his mountaintop.
Yeah.
And he was telling us about what a great club we were. And I'm thinking, well, I don't feel great at the moment. You know, I don't feel great. And he was the one that instilled a level of confidence into where we were going.
Mm.
And I find it incredible that a guy from the Basque region of Spain can feel so connected to our football club.
Yeah.
To want to build it in the way that he has built it, which is not just build it for your own personal gain, but build it properly from the bottom to the top with full alignment from the board right way down to the players. That is not something you do unless you really, really care about how you operate.
I agree. I think I had a little conversation with this with James on the Arscast Extra, that like when Mikel Arteta arrived as a player, the club was in a mess. When he arrived as manager, the club was in a mess. And I think he took responsibility as one of those senior players when he arrived in, because he was, 29 years of age, coming from Everton. You know, himself and Mertesacker really helped steady the ship. I think he took huge responsibility to ensure that the levels that we had come to expect at Arsenal were maintained. Like, you know, we didn't really challenge, but we didn't fall out of the top four either. You know, and when you consider, when you look back on some of those teams, you look back on the squad lists, you look back at some of the names of players who were appearing pretty regularly for us, I'm not saying it's a miracle, but, you know, a lot of hard work had to go into maintaining those top four finishes. And I think that's what it is. I think he came in, felt responsible, developed a real connection with the club and the fans over the years that he was here as a player and as a captain. You know, you saw, and everybody saw how he reacted on the day he retired. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Remember the, like, he came on as a sub. He was absolutely in bits. He was doing post-match interviews and he was like, he was distraught at the fact that he was going to A, call time on his playing career, but B, leave Arsenal. I think he knew he was going to leave Arsenal at that point because there was a coaching role for him. He decided to go and work with Pep Guardiola. You know, I think he knew that that was the end of his time at Arsenal. And I don't think he could have predicted that within such a short space of time, he would be back again in such an important role. Like maybe he thought one day, you know, I'll do my time under Pep. I might get a job here. I might get a job in Spain. I might, you know, work my way into the Premier League. And then maybe, maybe if everything aligns, there might be a time when I'm available and Arsenal is available and I could go back there. And what a moment that would be for me. I don't think he had any inkling on how could he that it would happen so quickly.
No, I don't think so. I think, as I said earlier, I think it's not just him getting the role. I'm glad he got the role at the right time because I think if he'd have got it after Wenger, I think the way we were, I think we'd have beaten him. You know, he barely got through the COVID period. You know, we weren't happy with some results around then.
Sure.
I think we'd have beaten him up. It would have been such a shame that that would have happened. And so I'm glad that it's worked out the way it has, the timing, the time for him to learn, particularly behind closed doors, make mistakes like people shouting at him from behind the dugout, and then develop a strategy based on, you know, changing the playing staff, etc., and creating something. And as you know, as I do, I mean, I think you spoke earlier about some of the people around the club who are re-engaging to the club. I think that's so interesting. And this whole experience of this season has maybe reminded me of the love that I had when we did have 98. It was like there was nothing to divide me away. And I think there's been so much division over recent years. He's come back in and reminded us how to love our football club again and what that means and what our role within that actually is. And Andrew, I know you've been over a couple of times to watch some games. You can feel the difference, right? So it's completely transformed. Completely transformed. And that is the nature of how he's built this. I do think we've only got to look across the road to see someone who's tried to build in a way that doesn't care about the club's base all the way to the top. He just cares about his reputation and building something for his success, not for the club's overall success. And I think if that's to their detriment, they're not looking at the overall end-to-end, whereas Arsenal are at the moment, and that's why this feels extraordinarily good. It's not just the results, it's the how we're operating. I think that's the key thing for me, and that's why we're so together, because we can't see any cracks at the moment. And if the results do change, I will look at how we're operating. If we're operating appropriately, I will console myself on that basis. If we're operating incorrectly, I think that's when you see cracks in our opinions, and that's when you get division come up again.
Sure. And look, I think it's probably evidence that results in football are the pretty much the be-all and end-all with regards to how people feel about things. That when results are good, it could be a consequence of everything else being good. Could be just a good run of form, whatever it is. Yeah. But, you know, widening the discussion out a little bit, you know, do we... it's not just a one-man show. You know, as good as Mikel Arteta has been, and he absolutely has been, there is a support structure around him now that probably, you know, wasn't there for Unai Emery. It's more settled. It's perhaps better. It's more driven towards the club's aims and ambitions. And that has been a huge factor in us being where we are. And, you know, you might even talk about the owners who've come in for plenty of criticism down the years, and I think rightly so and fair enough. But they have, to their credit, stuck with a plan and stuck with a manager when maybe the easy thing to do would have been to make the decision that most people in football make. But they realized, I think, that they have, you know, they had a rebuild to do. And you don't do a rebuild in 1 year or even 2 years, even if along that road there are some bumpy stretches.
Yeah, you mentioned Emery there, and I think one of the things where he failed, and maybe it was just a sign of the times and the structure we had in place at those times, because he worked on a different structure to Arteta. I don't think he was able to upward manage within the structure that he was brought into the club.
That's true.
So he was unable to influence in the mahogany rooms, as I always say. He was unable to influence at the board level. And that's the structure that we wanted. We wanted a coach. We wanted someone to look after the first team, and we'll deal with all the rest. No, you can't have that player. You can have this player.
Yeah.
That type of scenario. And then Mikel came in under the same structure, and then the structure changed. And then he had the same role. And then they changed his role. Remember that? Become manager. And that caused a few consternations with us, because we were thinking, are we going back to a single point of failure, a Wenger model where one person has too much power? But that was not the case. And I do think his ability to upward manage and to, with Edu and with others, no doubt, that have come into the club, Richard Garlick and Tim Lewis in particular, that group of people have managed to create a project and a program that everyone buys into. And I think that's the difference, whereas there was maybe some broken parts before. You know? So that end-to-end alignment is really key. So everyone knows where we're going. So everyone knows where they're going, and they're in the same room, and there's no one sneaking behind each other. No one's going to get fired.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, just in terms of, you know, that group that we've talked about, I remember, you know, people saying or people referencing the fact that with Arteta, with Edu, with Josh Kroenke, with Vinay, there was a group of guys who were all more or less in the same age bracket. You didn't have huge disparity between, let's say, you know, a young manager and a senior chairman, which can happen, you know?
Yeah.
The old guy does his thing and the young guy wants to do. I mean, do you think that sort of alignment of ages, and perhaps that might generate a sort of a dynamic because they're all around the same age, the same experiences, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that has been a part of what's happened?
I think so, because the modern leadership techniques, the modern project building, financial efficiencies, I think having people with like minds, I think helps. Having somebody senior, you know, if I was ever in that room, I would be the Steve Round, Andrea. I'd be that guy. But having that guy on the football side, just someone you can talk to and just make sure you're doing the right thing, who's been around, strong on the culture side of things, I think that's quite smart, having someone in their 50s, shall we say. I think that's quite smart. But this is where I do think it's result dependent, because I love what we're doing. So I can talk to it. I can talk to the journey. I'm interested in leadership. I'm interested in operational excellence. This is an interest to me, not just to football. So I love what I'm seeing. But if we didn't have the results, suddenly you've got the youngest manager in the league. Your technical director's only 6 months older than him. Who have you got on your board that knows anything about football? Do you see what I mean? You can see where it could go.
Yeah.
And I do think that is something that's result dependent, because as fans, we go places when things don't work. We either want the manager fired, or we want said player who we decided is the player that we can want to blame. We want him gone, right? And if we can't get to them, we want the board gone. Do you see what I mean? That's being a bit generalistic, but I'm just talking as a football fan. And so I do think having the results has allowed those guys to really develop their strategy, explain their strategy. Come on, mate. How many videos have we watched explaining the strategy, explaining the organizational structure, explaining what we're doing? That transparency, and I will say the transparency from the Amazon documentary alongside that has allowed us to create our own picture and form our own opinions. And luckily enough, the Arsenal fans have been much, you know, been very smart about how they're absorbing what's happening right now. And I think it's really, really positive.
So we have 10 games to go. We're in an unbelievable position. And I mean that in the most complimentary way possible, because we could have sat here on August the 1st, and I could sit here and talk to anybody on August the 1st, and I say to them, there's 10 games to go. Arsenal are top of the table by 8 points, albeit Man City have a game in hand. And you would say, put down the Rizzlers. You're smoking far too much. This is nonsense. You're living in a fucking dream world. How do you view this position? How do you, as you know, someone who's seen a few titles in your time, we've been through some successful seasons. I mean, it's a huge opportunity, isn't it, for these players, for these managers, for this team to really do something incredible at a stage in their careers for a lot of these guys where it's potentially replicable.
I tell you, I'm trying not to think. You know, honestly, I'm trying not to think about the potential good times we could have, you know?
Mm.
And there was a period where I took some of this for granted, where we were playing Bayern Munich in the Champions League. I was saying, should I go? Oh, I'm not sure. We'll play them next year. It's no drama, you know? And so that attitude's completely changed. You know, my favourite moment of the season is Bournemouth at home.
Well, I mean, fair enough.
So there you go, Bournemouth at home. And for anyone who was there, you know exactly what I mean. So, and so I have changed my attitude around the team. But what I will say, Andrew, is that I'm almost afraid to let myself go, you know, because it feels so this could happen. And if it happens, it would feel right, you know. There were things that happened at the end of last season that we didn't control very well, and some things were taken away from us regarding injuries that no one wants to refer to. They just want to say that we bottled it, but actually if certain players didn't come back from the international break injured, then we'd have been fine, you know.
Yeah.
And we'd be in Champions League already, but this is something else, right? This is something else, and this is something that I actually think is the start of something.
Sure.
Right? There's been a lot of discussion about this 5-point plan. Have you seen the chat about the 5-point plan? And we're at point three at the moment.
Yeah, the five phases of Mikel Arteta's plan, and we're in phase three ahead of schedule. It has to be said. He had admitted that.
So, so while we're walking around walking our dogs, I've been thinking about this 5-point plan and what could it be. And obviously, I think we're at the compete stage. I think that's fairly clear to all of us, right? We're the compete stage. And maybe stage four is the we want to win phase. You know? So but five, well, you know, five could be anything. And I'm thinking that step five is dominance. And I think the dominance phase starts now. And by that I mean how we purchase players in the summer. It's about creating a sustainable group that's going to be at the top end of the game for half a decade.
Mm.
And that has to start now. You have to plan now. You have to buy now. There's contractual opportunities that are out there. It has to be now. The base of the team, the youth of the players that we bought 2 years ago has been done. They are now building. Financial efficiencies within the wage bill, that's happened and happening, and there's still more to come to make sure that the people that we're spending money on inefficiently are moved on from the club to the players that we all want to see get the big contracts, they get their money. And we still have financial prudence over the overall group while creating room to be more dominant going forward.
Mm.
And so in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, this is the start of something. Regardless, however, there's an opportunity in this league this year that maybe has brought this forward 1 year sooner. And I think it's important that we grab it. And I think January showed us that the club recognised the window. And we spoke about that previously, Andrew, the window that's in front of us.
Yeah.
They recognise it. And look at the signings that we did. You know, they're not 5-year complete signings, you know, all of them, you know. So this is about making sure the project gets the boom it needs. You know, I think we're really close to that.
What do you think the players are going to be feeling at this point of the season? Because, you know, you might make the argument, you know, if you're young and you haven't been through this before, maybe it's a lot of pressure, but maybe there's also freedom from not having been through this before, that this is, you see this as an opportunity, a real chance to, you know, get yourself on the next stadium rep, even, you know, in 15 years time when they're doing all the consultations, you know, these guys could be on the side of the stadium, that kind of stuff. I mean, they must be hugely excited about all of this, all that lies ahead. And based on what we've seen from them so far this season, the way they have been able to cope with situations like haven't beaten Liverpool in fuck knows how long, you beat Liverpool. Haven't beaten Tottenham away since fuck knows how long, you beat them away. You know, all of these things that we have done this season are sort of fuel for these last 10 games.
I think these 10 games, there's some difficult games around you, to be honest.
Yeah.
But what you know, Brighton at home can be a difficult game. You know,
they're all difficult. You don't need to explain to me how difficult all of them are going to be, because I look at them on paper and go, tough, 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 tough. And, you know, that's the reality of Premier League. You know, what's interesting is we're playing pretty much every game against a team that also has something to play for. There's going to be no team that is in, you know, on the beach, in inverted commas, as you get towards the end of the season. They've all got something to play for: relegation, Europe, the title itself. You know, this is going to be part of how difficult it is.
And so you've half read my mind there, actually, because I was thinking about this, and all these teams are going to want to, they're going to come and play us. They're not going to sit around and sit in their penalty box, you know, like Newcastle did. Mm-hmm. They're going to come and play us. And I think we're very good when teams come to play us. I think our ability to transition through the thirds, I think, is really strong. Mm. And we need that. We need the pitch to be the size that we need it to be and control the areas that we want to control. So I think that's important. And what I will say, the Europa League taught me something, actually. Because we played quite strong teams in Europa League, and sometimes we had our best players on the pitch. Mm-hmm. But, mate, I'm telling you, the focus of those players was not the same as it was at Leicester, at Fulham, against Palace. You could just tell by the way that ball was moving around that pitch. The edge to the players, it was different. They have, for me, long since targeted this Premier League title. And you've just got to, honestly, I listened to that ball was moving at Palace. It was moving. I could hear it. This was 2 days after going out Europa League, literally. Mm. And I was concerned about our fatigue levels and our sharpness levels, our mentality levels. Within 5 minutes, I just sat back. I'd said, this is it. This is on, you know, and that's what's being transmitted from the grass up to me. And we won the game handily, and they had their moments, but I didn't have a moment's doubt. That focus and edge, that's where I think the managers had done a fantastic job to sustain that in places where we don't normally sustain it. Mm. As you said, at Tottenham, you know, Manchester United, we were unlucky to lose away to them, but then we sorted them out when they came back. Liverpool, we don't do stuff against them. Mm. You know, that Brighton game at Christmas, that was a huge game, huge performance. You know, people worried about Fulham. They got dealt with. These are things that we previously stumbled. But again, I go back to how and the edge and the focus and the zip of that ball and the sprinting speed and the collaborative nature by which we play, that doesn't just happen. That tells me that everyone's on it, you know, and the Europa League showed me when we're not quite on it and when we're there, but we're just jogging our way through. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Hoping to win it at 80%. So that's what gives me comfort that for the next 10 games, we're going to be at the level that we need to be. And my only worry is injuries to key players, which we could all name.
We can, obviously, and we're sweating on Thomas Partey after an international duty. We don't know anything about William Saliba yet as we sit here talking. Mm. We do know that Takahiro Tomiyasu is out for the rest of the season. And, you know, we haven't had a great deal of chance to have a conversation about that. I'd like to ask you how significant you think that is, because I guess people will think he's been in and out a bit this season. He's been a bit peripheral. Ben White has taken his place at right back. But Tomiyasu has 31 appearances this season. Wow. You know, he if you remember, started that game against Liverpool at left back.
Yeah.
He is, I suppose, I think it was James said it to me, he just said he's basically the fifth defender, because he can play at right back, he can play at left back, he can play at centre half if you need a centre half. He is the utility man, the Swiss Army knife defender of this team, and he's gone now. I mean, do you think it is going to be a significant injury, or is there sufficient depth within this squad to be able to cope without Tomiyasu, who hasn't been a starter in fairness, but I do think is maybe a more important piece of this puzzle than people give him credit for?
I agree, and the amount of games that he's come on for Ben White, and Ben White, touchwood, stayed injury free, because Tomiyasu's there taking up some of those minutes and a little bit of rotation, and Ben White was basically man of match in the last game. It was just superb. And so I do think he will be missed. And so what this naturally forces us to start to speculate on how we're going to add that depth. And there's two or three players we just bring to the discussion right now. So Kieran Tierney is getting a lot more press, shall we say. You know, has he been used appropriately? You know, can he be a bit more versatile? Are we being fair to him? So that's another discussion point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rob Holding's come in, did really well against Palace. You know, how far can he go? Can he start to share minutes towards the end of games, particularly? Potential, that's an option. There's obviously a new signing, Jakob Kivior, that had two games over the international break. I did read, and I haven't seen it in my own eyes, so I'm up for a kick in here. I did read that he didn't have a good game in the first game in the international break, but in the second game was much improved. And he played at left back in the second game. And so, again, somebody that maybe we don't fully understand his versatility.
Yeah.
Somebody maybe we don't understand how his role in the squad going forward and potential sales, etc. So I do think this is where the manager has got to make the right decisions. And if I have a fear, Andrew, apart from injury, it's our reaction to injury. So, I don't want to see, and I'm not saying it's going to happen this season, but I don't want to see Granit Xhaka playing left back, shall we say.
Sure.
And I don't want to see Thomas Partey playing right back. You know, do you see what I mean? And these things are important. And so when pressure comes on board, it forces you to make decisions under pressure. And those ones need to be correct. And in my mind, quite conservative. And he's done that well. The discussion around Rob Holding pre the last game, I'm so glad he played him. You have to play him.
Well, who else did he have? Who else could he have played in that position?
Well, people were doing all sorts of mental maths to see him not play, right?
Well, I mean, that's why I don't look at, you know, Twitter. Twitter in the hour after a lineup is posted is just like, I can't really understand it. But I don't know who else we had in that position. I understand if people were a little bit anxious about Rob Holding, because one of his last Premier League games, Premier League starts for us, was that nightmare at White Hart Lane, right?
Yeah.
And he hasn't started all season because we've had Saliba and Gabriel, that partnership that you know has been so fundamental to what we've done. But in the circumstances, what else was there? I mean, I think you absolutely kill Rob Holding for the remainder of this season. Whatever happens in the summer, we don't know what's going to happen in the summer. But you can't lose a player through injury and then lose a player because you've just murdered him with your team selection.
Yeah. You can't start playing like two left footers at centre back and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And people think all sorts of things, you know, to not let him play. And he played that game like he'd listened to everybody's chatter.
And or the manager.
I've never seen him so focused. Wow, he was pinging that ball left to right. He was so ferocious in the first ball, then settled down like he does and looked absolutely fine. And I do think, you know, Andrew, when... joke aside about the Bournemouth game, it was so intoxicating. And all those people that weren't playing are thinking, I want to have my Bournemouth moment like Reece Nelson had.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe Rob Holding had it at Crystal Palace up to a point, and maybe he might play at the weekend. We don't know, right? So, and I do think if I'm on that bench, I'm thinking, I want my moment. So the moment they call my number, I'm going to be ready. I don't want to be the reason why we don't have a positive last 10 games.
Sure.
So I'll be training harder. I'll be making sure I listen to all the coach details harder. I want to be ready. And so the depth question, I think, will be answered by how the group feels about each other. And players like Rob Holding can exceed our expectations because they all want to achieve what we want together.
Let me just finish with this one, because there's talk about Bukayo Saka and his new contract and how much he might earn and all that kind of stuff, which I'm really not interested in. Whatever the club decide to pay Bukayo Saka, I think he's earned it. He is probably the most underpaid player in the Premier League at this moment in time. So whatever he gets from this contract is fine by me. But I want to ask you, what does it say? And I know I'm, you know, maybe jumping the gun a little bit, but basically, you know, the whole story is it's all agreed and it's just a matter of announcing it now. What does it say about this club right now, this project, this team, whatever way you want to put it, that England's best player at 21 years of age is committing his future to Arsenal?
I don't think we can overstate how important this is, because of who he is and how his football life has gone so far and what he means to the club, at every level of the club. Can you imagine what it's like at Hale End at the moment, watching him and watching him doing what he's doing? Every one of them will be just absolutely, won't be able to go to sleep. They must be dreaming, right? So, and then you look at how he operates at the Arsenal level and the effect he has on the pitch with his goals and assists. And I'm not talking the fourth goal versus Everton. I'm talking the first goal.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
The first cross, the first assist, the stuff that really matters. What do you do for England? England are bumbling along. I'll tell you what, I'll just give an assist to that bloke who takes all the glory. I'll give him a goal, and then I will stick one in the top corner, and the game's over. Yeah. Maybe the manager could have rewarded him or taken him off, but now we'll just flog him, shall we? So, I think how he is, Andrew, and as we started this conversation around why we support Arsenal, the players that open the door for us, can you imagine how many people right now are thinking about Arsenal as their club because of this kid?
Sure.
He's their Thierry Henry, right? He is their Patrick Vieira. He is their Liam Brady, Paul Davis.
David Rocastle. I was on the Highbury Squad podcast with Kevin Campbell and Sophie the other night, and there were some comparisons made with David Rocastle, you know, a brilliant footballer who's come through the academy, but at the same time, a person that everybody just loves. Everybody who meets Bukayo Saka, they talk about him in glowing terms, as was the case with David Rocastle, you know? Yeah. So he's like the gateway drug into a lifetime of Arsenal for this new generation, I guess.
Yeah, and and obviously the difference then between Rocastle and maybe Bukayo Saka is, maybe I may be talking out of turn here, but the game feels a lot more global now. And obviously we are connected globally via the interweb.
Sure.
We are connected. And so it's a constant stream of information. It's a constant stream of chat. And he's coming up in this generation. So his impact is hundredfold in comparison to the players that brought us into the room, shall we say. You know, and so as far as I'm concerned, him and others are so important to the growth of this club. And so as for the numbers, they'll take care of themselves. There's a market, and they'll take, I don't particularly care. I do think what I do care about is potentially the incentives versus the flat. You know, I think we've been burned by that recently. And I think this contract will be instructive to how we want to pay our best people and how we want to incentivize them at the same time. I think it'll be quite instructive on that. So I am interested in that, but I don't expect everyone to be interested in that. But I do remember a bloke called Mesut Ozil and Aubameyang, and I do remember their performances after contracts were signed. based on contracts before they signed them. And so I am keen to see that. But I'm also keen that there are more people like Bukayo Saka coming through. And I think that's the key thing. People that behave that way, that are bought into club that way, and like Arteta, feel this is the place for them to be. And that wasn't always the case. We were a stepping stone to other places, and people that did decide to stay, make sure they got paid and their motivations were, may not be as I would have liked to have seen, you know, not fully with Arsenal. So the way he behaves, the way he operates, the way that other players in that group of young players that we brought in think this is the place they want to stay for many years and want to make us very, very good again. It just all feels very positive at the moment, right? So we've got nothing to moan about, Andrew, have we? What are we going to do?
Well, I'm sure we'll cope. I'm much happier without anything to moan about, to be perfectly honest. So,
me too.
You know, we will hopefully be having happy and positive conversations all the way through until the end of May. At which point we can maybe sit down and talk about it after that. But let's keep fingers crossed, one game at a time and all the rest. Clive, as always, a pleasure.
Loved it, mate. Take care.
Thanks to Clive. You can find him on Twitter. He is at ClivePAFC, at ClivePAFC. And of course, he's part of the Arsenal Vision podcast crew. You can find that show in all the usual places or at ArsenalVisionPodcast.com. We are teaming up again for an event very shortly in New York, which went on sale to our Patreon members and sold out within about 30 minutes. So that is one of the benefits of being a Patreon member, by the way. You get early access to tickets, and the demand is such that it might be the only access to tickets going forward for any other events that we might have planned between now and the end of the season, which you might or might not want to keep an eye out for. So we're looking forward to seeing some of you guys in New York City on the weekend of the West Ham game. So that's all very exciting. We do play Leeds, of course, this weekend, but that is a game we'll talk about in more detail on Patreon. We'll have our usual Premier League preview podcast with Lewis. We will do that for you on Friday, so that will be available for you Friday afternoon over on Patreon, patreon.com/arseblog. For now, I'm going to leave it there. We will have an Arsecast extra for you on Monday, talking about everything that happens in the Leeds game. Fingers crossed, 3 points. We want Liverpool to win this weekend, too. They're taking on Manchester City. They've blown hot and cold, it's fair to say, this season. Fingers crossed they're hot as balls tomorrow. And if we can beat Leeds, well, wouldn't that be a thing? Fingers crossed. Have a great weekend, folks. Talk to you all on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye. And as we continue our tour of the Manchester City training ground, you'll see this area over here where players can work on specialities of the game. And actually, you're in luck. We've got a player coming in right now to work on something very specific, one of our best players. This is Rodri. He's a Spanish international. You'll see here he's about to embark on a shooting drill. And let's see what you got, Rodri. Stand by, folks. I think you'll enjoy this. Oh, God, not that kind of shooting, you madman! He's just aiming at anything wearing red and white! Oh, fuck!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.